Well, many, many thanks, Jennifer. First of all, for the invitation and all the organization that you, Virla and Atera, have done to bring me and my wife here, and to Eric for volunteering to enter into the dialogue. And I think this seems to be a great space for dialogue rather than just one-way communication. So I was happy to bring something that I thought would be relevant to a European setting in talking about American art, celebrating not only a great artist like Mark Rothko, but a very significant, indeed a great scholar and art historian in Meyer Shapiro, whose work, he had two fields, medieval art and the modern art, contemporary art of his time. And his medieval interests were largely in the Romanesque and spanned France and northern Spain, as well as much further afield. So I thought all those things in many ways suited the occasion. So according to, I don't know whether the format is like this every time, but I prepared about a half an hour. So I tried to keep it concise, and I should stop my preamble so it remains concise. And you know, and then after Eric has his response, then we will, as Jennifer said, we'll open it up to a discussion. You've been looking at a photograph the whole time you've been here, taken by the Hans Nemuth around 1964, showing Mark Rothko alone in his summer studio out on the east end of Long Island in Amagansett, seated in an Adirondack chair, a style very characteristic of American summer residences, facing away from the camera, with his regard fixed on a painting in smoldering russet and red hues that leans against another smaller canvas, which is turned towards the wall. To his right, suspended by two cords from a beam of the roof, hangs a canvas of similar size but painted in dark pigments approaching black, and no other work is visible. Well, having that photograph up as you were entering and waiting, in fact, reproduces the experience that theater goers have had and continue to have over the last several years at the performances of John Logan's play Red. And I don't know how well, if that play is known in France yet at all. It began at the Donmar Warehouse in London, traveled to Broadway a couple of years ago, and now I see is being performed really all over the English-speaking world. When I was in Brisbane, Australia, there was a production of Red just about to begin. And when you entered the theater, the curtain was up, and the actor playing Rothko was sitting in an Adirondack chair facing away from the audience, looking at a painting that was largely red. That went on for a silent half an hour, which kept the house in a sort of hushed state of anticipation, with hardly anyone talking or making the usual kinds of ruckus as they took their seats. Now, John Logan's chosen moment for dramatizing Rothko's creative anxiety, which is the subject of the play, lay some years before the actual date of the Nemuth photograph. It was during the very fraught gestation of, we have the next slide, fraught gestation of the paintings that had originally been commissioned for the Four Seasons restaurant in the Seagram Building on Park Avenue in New York, the core of which Rothko later donated to the Tate Gallery. A lot of reported grumbles by Rothko concerning the restaurant's smugly wealthy clientele provided Logan with the exchanges he needed to highlight in dialogue both the artist's social disaffection and a fictional assistant's youthful idealism as a foil to Rothko's remarks. Scattered passages gleaned from his writings also were inserted to dramatize his accompanying creative anxieties. And you can hear a synthesis of some of these in the following clip. Alfred Molina and Eddie Redmayne.
So, now what do you see? Be specific? No. Be exact. Be exact, but sensitive. You understand? Be kind. Be a human being, that's all I can say. Be a human being for once in your life. These pictures deserve compassion, and they live or die in the eye of the sensitive viewer. They quicken only if the empathetic viewer will let them. That is what they cry out for. That is why they were created. That is what they deserve. Now, what do you see?
Right.
But do you like it? Speak up.
Yes.
Yes, of course you like it. How could you not like it? Everyone likes everything nowadays. Like the television and the phonograph and the soda pop, the shampoo and the Cracker Jack. Everything becomes everything else, and it's all nice and pretty and likable. Everything is fun in the sun, huh? Where's the discernment? Where's the arbitration that separates what I like from what I respect? What I deem worthy? What has, listen to me, significance?
Fade. Okay, next slide. Well, virtually everything you just heard coming out of the actor Alfred Molina's mouth could be found somewhere in Rothko's recorded remarks and his own writing, some of which you'll be hearing from me. But the most quoted line seems to be one entirely of the playwright's invention, where Rothko says to his young assistant, there are only two characters in the play, he says, there is only one thing I fear in life, my friend. One day the black will swallow the red, end quote. Well, at a first level, a heavy-handed intimation of Rothko's suicide in 1970, which typifies the script's adherence to an obvious life versus death symbolism so conveniently mapped onto the sanguine red and the Stygian black. The next slide. But I think the Namath image carries a lesson quite different from that kind of chromatic psychomachia. The change in Rothko's idiom from the freely brushed windows and gates of the 1958 Seagram series is equally visible here a few years later in both the reddish and the blackish canvases. That is, now what we see is a containment of a single rectangle within a sharply defined border, suspended against a field in the same family of tone or hue. Now, red in this instance might be the object of Rothko's immediate scrutiny, but the dark variant is the one that will come to dominate his efforts from the mid-1960s through the long campaign that produced the murals for the Houston Chapel. Next slide. But not, I think, as a despairing coda to his career, but as an impetus to new creative energies. Now, it would be a lot to ask of a two-character play to capture that more profound aesthetic reality, and I don't really mean to disparage Red as a work of drama. It's pretty impressive, and I recommend it if you ever get the chance to see a production. Rothko may have been largely private in his habits and resentful of uninvited attention. But he also possessed an inclination to drama, both as an idea and in the theater of his own life. His very public repudiation of the Seagram Commission offers an example of his biographical drama. And his earliest ideas about pictorial form betray an attachment to the stage as a model for creating meaning in art. Going back to the 1940s, Rothko wrote and published an essay called "The Romantics Were Prompted." And he declared, kind of the next slide, please, and I quote, "I think of my pictures as dramas. The shapes in the pictures are the performers. They have been created from the need for a group of actors who are able to move dramatically and execute gestures without shame," end quote. And in the following decade, he extended the implications of that analogy, in the process castigating his own admirers, that is, the ones who took his pictures for being somehow serene, harmonious, and at rest. He had a reply for them, which reappears obsessively in the unpublished drafts of an essay that he planned in the mid-1950s on Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy, a favorite text of his. Addressing, quote, "those who are friendly to my pictures on the basis of their serenity, I would like to say that they have found endurable for human life the extreme violence that pervades every inch of their surface," end quote. And in another version of that same essay, he speaks with even greater vehemence of having, quote, "imprisoned the most utter violence in every inch of their surface." And he knew that many would resist seeing, again, his words, "the wild terror and suffering and blind drives and aspirations raging within his glowing fields of pigment." But he had his answer ready, quoting again, "and if they ask why I have adopted a form which might, to some, be deceptive, why I have not used the physical means of agitation, of speed, of fast motion, I can only answer that this is the way in which I could achieve the greatest intensity of the tragic irreconcilability of the basic violence which lies at the bottom of human existence and the daily life which must deal with it," end quote. Now, given that Rothko prescribed the scale of normal living, the sort of close-up view you see him indulging in here, as the one within which his paintings were meant to be seen, I think we can take this last reference to daily life as representing no suppression of the violent stratum of his imagination, but its necessary complement. It required the intimacy of a familiar presence in order for the viewer to perceive the vehemence he intended to live within his tissue of painted marks. Now, his thoughts were linked to the earlier ones that he had set down in the essay, "The Romantics Were Prompted." But nowhere in that earlier piece of writing had he intimated the extremism of the actions he imagined being performed by, quote, again, his actors who are able to move dramatically and execute gestures without shame. The Nietzsche drafts of the next decade invest his pictures as dramas with an almost apocalyptic fervor. But we have to ask, where had he deposited these actors in their elemental conflicts? Where are we to find them in these resolutely non-representational fields? Hadn't he earlier asserted in the same essay, "The Romantics Were Prompted," that, quote, "the familiar identity of things has to be pulverized in order to destroy the finite associations with which our society increasingly enshrouds every aspect of our environment"? I think John Logan and Molina did kind of capture the tone that you see coming through in many of these pronouncements. And though these lines are not in the play, you can kind of imagine that they could have been. But again, I'm asking, where do we find his actors and their conflicted scenarios inside his paintings rather than on the stage of Red? Well, I think the place to start, next slide, would be the Triumph, the painting that really is the culmination of his first quasi-surrealist phase of his career. A large canvas he called Slow Swirl at the Edge of the Sea, which is now a key holding of the Museum of Modern Art in New York. It's surprisingly monumental in scale, and next slide, please, dominates in size its actual model from the same collection. That is Joan Miró's The Hunter or Catalan Landscape from 1927. Next slide, please. Just to see the comparison between the two. It's impressive as a work of art to this day, but it also bears the marks, I think, of a certain awkward lunge toward major status. Its dependency on the Miró is the start of that. His Rothko's effort to scale the Miró up subjects Rothko's shapes to a kind of methodical discipline, closer to a scientific diagram than to a living ecology, with the two color bands, forming a shallow shelf and wall for the display of these specimens, which include, next slide, a dutiful, almost pedantic quotation of signature devices from Picasso and Braque's Cubism as well, next slide, as well as quotations from Duchamp's Large Glass. In 1945, shortly afterwards then, next slide please, Rothko gave the title Primeval Landscape to a smaller, more reduced version of the same format, this time on paper, which helps us identify a local correlative, we might even say a source for the format, one that he appears to have concluded gave access to modern viewers, access to the primary truths that he believed had been familiar to archaic humanity via the belief of ancient societies in the reality of the supernatural. During the early 1940s, Rothko was close to the great Columbia University art historian Meyer Shapiro, as we've already remarked. Both of them were active in an avant-garde exhibiting society, and through this association, Rothko came to know Shapiro's preoccupation in his life and scholarship with the medieval art found in the Romanesque Abbey of Santo Domingo de Silos. Next slide, please, in northern Spain, into which Shapiro projected much of his utopian political imagination. The core of Shapiro's fascination with the monastery's art history, first of all, lay in the phenomenon of two drastically different stylistic vocabularies being used at a single place and time. A fact that confounded the standard assumption by medieval art historians that any given historical moment possessed one distinctive and diagnostic style of art. In the late 11th century, the monks had commissioned sculpture for their cloister that announced the expressive naturalism of the Romanesque style. Next slide. That's the cloister. These are sculpture on one of the piers that announces figures that manifest a new physical and psychological animation in the treatment of the human figure. They now seem to step forward, to turn and twist in actual space. But at the same time, the monks themselves, not the secular artisans whom they commissioned to do these sculptures, but the monks themselves were copying and illustrating, next slide please, an 8th century retelling and commentary on the biblical apocalypse, using what was then the centuries-old Mozarabic style. In the manuscript, human beings and other living or imaginary creatures were reduced to two-dimensional diagrams set against flat bands of brilliant color. Harking back, so Shapiro saw it, to a mental state of unquestioning belief in the supernatural. The sculpture spoke instead to the changing needs of the church in its accommodation of emergent secular interests and energies. In one of the greatest articles, I think, ever written by an art historian, Shapiro argued that this contradiction, you know, made one aware of the role of conflict in historical change itself, being on the cusp of two, you know, distinct and almost contradictory attitudes toward the position of human beings vis-a-vis other powers within the universe. And he went so far as to test the proposition by living for an extended period in the Silos Monastery and establishing a deeply sympathetic relationship with the monks themselves, an experience that paradoxically actually strengthened his Marxist convictions. And this particular conflict between belief and secularization was one in which Shapiro's friend Rothko took an intense interest for the purposes of his art. Next slide. In Primeval Landscape, we can see him adapting the Mozarabic manuscript format directly, now that we know about it, and know, in fact, that there were very good examples of Beatus apocalypses in the Mozarabic style in the Morgan Library in New York. One of the curators who worked with him in this period, the Chicago curator Catherine Koo, who organized his first museum retrospective in 1955, recalled that Rothko found most painters of the past, Turner and Rembrandt excepted, slightly distasteful. Indeed, he deplored the whole Renaissance. And going back to the Romantics were prompted, we find Rothko aligning himself with, and I quote, the archaic artist who had an uncanny virtuosity, finding it necessary to create a group of intermediaries, monsters, hybrids, gods, and demigods. The difference is that, since the archaic artist was living in a more practical society than ours, the urgency for transcendent experience was understood and given an official status, end quote, something he remarks with approval. And the title of this work forthrightly signals the archaism that Rothko plainly relished in the Mozarabic manuscript pages. But then the problem becomes how to use that recognition in an art that would be recognizably his own. Successfully pulverizing the finite associations that came with any existing, you know, visual vocabulary proved to be, for him, a halting process. The next slide, please. In 1948, for example, in a work like this, one of a series he called Multiforms, the contours and the visible skeletons of the old mythopoetic creatures reappear, clinging to the roughly geometric shapes of the multiform, vaguely rectangular entities, which seem to swim in a colored environment. But when he takes away the contours, next slide, please. Also in a piece from 1948, their geometry relaxes and the shapes resume a quasi-biological motility at the price of a pronounced lack of focus. And he finds himself caught for a time in an oscillation between these poles as a work from 1949. Next slide, please. I think definitely demonstrates. He reverts here to the drawing of outlines, though these now tend to resemble halos more than confining edges. But that device points toward the next plateau in his development, that is, the consolidation of these somewhat placeless and slack shapes, which are neither taut in their geometry nor truly unconfined, into larger forms by, in effect, sliding them one behind the other, lending a depth and a substance that no single color or shape could exhibit on its own. Next slide, please. So in this work, Multiform, number 8 from 1949, the rectangular shapes appear stacked and seem partly edgewise like so many translucent panes of glass. So what I think it culminates here is Rothko beginning with the banded background and the fantastic or surrealistic beings displayed against the colored banded background. What had been static, that is, the bands, become active. And what had been active, that is, the original actors on the stage that they provide, become static divisions and boundaries. His mature format had to contain both qualities in a tense but roughly equal balance, which entailed yet more hesitant experiment. Next slide, please. Contours still often wander around in his paintings of 1949 to 1950 like so many underweight junior partners to the increasingly assertive larger rectangles. Here they assume a symmetrically formal framing function, like the ornament of a manuscript page, but they rest rather uncomfortably in that obsolete function, orphaned remainders excluded from the essential action of interleaving the translucent fields of color that have become Rothko's star performers. In number 5, 1950, he let thin lines of underpainting show through as if he had scored the center panel with the sharp end of a brush handle in some compulsive reassertion of the act of drawing. In this work, and also in number 5, 1949, next one, discrete cursive forms convert the larger backgrounds, I think regressively, into the equivalents of fossil layers or ocean currents. That is, they revert to the banded background function of the old manuscript pages without fully manifesting the actorly presence and forward animation that he will capture in his best work. And I think one can tell from what came after that these were no more than provisional stopping points. He still wanted definition and drawing, but that drawing would henceforth have to come about as a byproduct of bringing his large, expansive fields to life. Next slide, please. He knows this, you're looking at number 10, 1950, which represented his breakthrough into the collection of the Museum of Modern Art. Though the president of the museum's board of trustees resigned in protest over Alfred Barr's purchase of the painting. But we see, I think, in this canvas, and I think Barr's perceptions were spot on, we see drawing, as I say, in abundance in this canvas, but Rothko is no longer setting contours to guide the subsequent filling in or modeling of an area. His drawing arrived at the same time and out of the same procedures as constituted the color field. There's no reason to assume that drawing isn't present in every stroke, but it happens in the painterly drama at the margins. It's there where the white mass pulls away from the edge on the lower right-hand corner. It's why the yellow and white fields come together but refuse to touch. Why the gravity-bound path of the brownish drips expose the geometry of the rectangle of the same color that's largely masked. Can we have the next slide, please? Largely masked by the white overlay of nearly identical size and position. So looking closer, as you can do here, one sees that the white area is not just one. It's composed of two separate shapes, at least, either joining or overlying one another, which yields a set of horizontal seams balanced by less distinct but still emphatic striations along the vertical axis. So closer looking of the kind that we saw Rothko manifesting in his close examination in the photograph of his own canvases, close looking transforms one big white rectangle into massed ranks of slightly shifted superimposed rectangles, which borrow further contrast and definition from the darker double or doppelganger underneath, likely as not just as complex in its own composition. Rothko's shapes, his actors, are thus never singular. They're multiple, which both lends the paintings their depth in the suspended fields and energizes the edges where the visual cues coalesce and propel one's awareness back into the interiors with a heightened apprehension of their status as congeries of many delicately coincident blocks of translucent color. If you think about geometrical composition in an earlier 20th century suprematist or constructivist or de Stael manner, those artists disposed their rectangles laterally across the surface. Rothko disposed them in depth behind the surface, which required their overlapping to be nearly complete, save for all those small, minimally revealing slippages at the margins. Next slide, please. This canvas from 1955 shows that he could, as he went on, conjoin such multiple presences in depth with just two large, apparently unified rectangles. Against the powerful effect of simplicity at first encounter, the activity at the margins becomes all the more intense and absorbing, asking for acuity of attention rather than relaxation into reverie. So next slide, please. So we come back to the Nemuth photograph of Rothko in his studio, and there appears to have been a marked change in his approach. If we look at a painting like the one to his right in the photograph, next slide, please, it's not only, as the play Red would have it, the dark palette that seems to signal the artist's increasing isolation. The simple division of the painting's surface leaves no room for those responsive presences that he had discovered when he began fusing his static colored backgrounds into the life of his active foreground actors. But maybe not. A few years later, as he prepared the enormous canvases for the chapel in Houston, he inaugurated a new kind of hard-edged frame. Next slide. The visible portion of a plum-colored underlayer brushed on in washy layers. Then within that outer margin, next slide please, he painted a rectangle very close in value to the border, but moving toward black, suffused with an alizarin crimson pigment. These ultimate layerings he did himself out of the view of his assistant, using a concoction, a medium of pigment and solvents that were entirely of his own invention. Can we go back, actually? From a distance, it might seem that in John Logan's phrasing, the black has finally swallowed the red. Go forward again. But up close, another kind of drama is occurring. The red has only migrated into a microtonal range within which his large contrasts of the past give way to granular adjustments of hues, hues so subdued that they work as much with the reflectivity of ambient light as they do with color perception. We have next slide, please. A single canvas from the Houston series in the New York studio where he painted them. And the next slide, please, going closer. You begin to see the activity emerging from the depths of that central field. The immediate impression of a uniform hue in muted black yields with prolonged observation to wave or cloud-like patterns. Next slide, please. Reacting with the incident of light. Maybe we could turn the lights down a little bit. These are close-up details that I made myself in Houston that, you know, do come to life, and I think I can still see my text or remember it well enough to to carry on, that react with the incident of light on the translucent physical surface and on the deeper layers underneath. Once one adjusts one's eyes to the painting's compressed tonal range, they actually seethe with incident, cloudy forms blooming and shifting and receding again into the depths in a kind of protean profusion, generated from the interaction of up to five distinct layers of dilute pigments. So in these monumental works, Rothko found other ways to make color behave, techniques that remain almost impervious to photographic reproduction. Let's have another slide. You can see another attempt on my part to try to capture them. The prolonged contemplation invited by the Rothko Chapel, which Rothko himself sadly did not live long enough ever to see, should not be relegated to the category of reverie or vague, new agey, you know, religious sentiment, but instead restored to the quality of heightened dialogue that visitors to Rothko's studio, next slide please, experienced while he was making the paintings. What do you see? Indeed, he would ask over and over again to everyone who came in, what do you see? Look from over here. Look in this light, he would exhort them. And that, at least, John Logan's Red gets right. And the paintings remain to do that for him, I think, if we just let them. So thank you very much for your attention.
Am I supposed to add something? I don't know what I can add. No, thank you, Tom, for this very enlightening lecture. I think as always in your work, we can see how the various changes in focus, looking from afar, looking from up close, are really revealing. And it made me think of a few things. So I don't know if I'm going to be precise enough, because I haven't prepared much. So. Maybe, I don't know if you agree with that, maybe we can discuss some things a little bit. Well, knowing that you were going to speak about Rothko in relationship with Shapiro, I just thought a little bit about what the two have in common that is... I mean, away from more from the fact that they knew each other, and as you said, Rothko was interested in what kind of research Shapiro was doing in the 1930s, early 1940s. And I think that, I mean, if I understood you correctly, you're making a general view of the evolution of Rothko's work as going from something that includes a lot of events to something where the events are inside and more minute than these kinds of events, taking into consideration his ideas of colors or forms as actors in the paintings. For me, I was just thinking about this evolution of Rothko's work and the evolution of Maya Shapiro's thinking on abstraction. And we have sort of, I mean, I don't know whether it's a complete parallel, but I would try to give an idea of a possible parallel. In 1936, Shapiro writes a very important essay on abstraction, which is the social basis of art. It's, in fact, a review of the Cubism and Abstract Art exhibition, and more of the, I mean, more than a review of the exhibition, it's a review of the catalog essay by Barr. And his second main essay on abstraction was published in 1957, and it's called The Liberating Quality of the Avant-Garde. It was published in Art News and first delivered as a lecture in Houston, if I remember correctly. So there are some connections also, maybe. I mean, this is completely secondary. But and what strikes me when thinking about the two essays is the fact that in the 1930s, Shapiro sees abstraction as addressing a community. I mean, as being linked with the politicized view of society as a community and as groups. And in 1957, he only speaks about the individuals. It's not society as a whole which can be liberated through abstraction. It's just one individual after the other. And I'm just wondering whether in the evolution of Rothko's art from something where you can read a story from afar, where you can see that something is happening that you can decipher and separate, where you have very distinct actors, one next to the other, on maybe a background, a very identifiable background also, which means that even seen from afar, it works. So it addresses somehow a potential community. And when you go to the later works, then you come with something different. They need to be looked at very closely, as you said, and as you showed in the pictures, in the photographs by Namuth and the others, which means that only an individual, one by one, can be actually seeing something. That if you are in a room with others, surrounded by paintings, you can't see anything. And maybe that's also what was so crucial about his disappointment with the Seagram murals. Incidentally, there's a play that's actually, I don't know whether it's already premiered or not, but Romeo Castellucci has just written a play on the same episode, and I think it's going to be quite different from the play by the slogan you mentioned, if I know what Castellucci is normally doing. And it's really a play about the Seagram mural. I mean, as usual, I guess, with Castellucci, it's coming from the Seagram murals and going somewhere else. But I'm really struck by this idea that you go from the idea of abstraction as a universal language to, so it can be linked to the idea of communication, of communicating something, an idea, even if it's tragedy, even if it's, but it has to be, it is something, to something that can only be addressed to one single person in a state of communion and not linked with communication. I don't know whether the parallel is completely accurate. It's just that what's interesting is that, in fact, I thought about that while listening to what you were saying. We should be very aware and maybe pay attention to the fact that abstraction in the 1940s is not the same thing as abstraction in the 1950s or 60s, even for someone like Rothko. And we have a tendency to think about his work as just one way of painting, and your reading showed very clearly that it, in fact, it's very diverse. And it's not even, as it's meant to be in the play by Logan, a teleological way of painting. I mean, you have, after the dark paintings, you have some paintings with very bright colors and things like that. So it doesn't work that way. But it's also the general context, which has changed completely. And I don't know whether Rothko was aware of it or not, but then this changing context forced him, as Shapiro had explained very clearly in The Social Basis of Art, an artist was forced by the context to adopt a new language, to adopt a new way of addressing questions and public. Rothko was forced somehow to change his language, to adapt to the new situation. I don't know whether he was conscious of that. Shapiro was obviously very conscious of that, because I don't know whether there's, I didn't take the time to check whether he ever mentioned Rothko in his writings or not. But we know that in the 50s he organized, he curated at least two exhibitions about second generation abstract expressionism. And the second one, which was in 1957 also, which was called Artist of the New York School Second Generation at the Jewish Museum, included people like Rauschenberg or Jasper Johns. So he was very aware that something had changed completely. So when he writes about abstraction in the 1950s, he's adapting to this new situation. I don't know whether Rothko was paying any attention to this environment. From what I think I know, he was very reluctant to acknowledge the changes that were happening around. But what I find interesting is the fact that even inside the vocabulary of abstract expressionism, he had to adjust in one way or another, at least to find new ways. And it's very clear in the pictures. If you look at the pictures, you can see how also he adjusts to the new environments that had appeared. Refrains from organizing complete environments as he had been doing in his early 1950s exhibitions, where he was installing the paintings as we see in one photograph that you showed, I think of 1950 or 1951, I don't remember, where you can see that he fits the painting exactly between the ceiling and the floor. He chooses for an exhibition in a gallery a canvas which is exactly the size of the wall, which doesn't leave any space around it. Whereas in the Rothko Chapel, or even in the views that we have from his studio where he was painted them, you have a lot of free space around. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I know what to do with these remarks. But it's just a few things I was thinking while listening to what you were to what you were saying. That finally, I don't know if it's the right way to phrase it, but there are some political questions behind this evolution, both in Shapiro's writing and in Rothko's writing, and they're not as simple as what we've been led to think. They're not only going from Marxism to Trotskyism to some kind of free enterprise, market orientated thinking. I mean, post-war FBI-induced thinking or something like that. The question is a little bit more complex. And I mean, I'm sorry not to be able to say more about that, because it's only very rough ideas that are also reactions. But thank you. At least it gives me some hints about what I should be working on.
Well, I think it was a very, very learned response, and I'm very grateful to have it. And it sets me thinking about aspects, especially of the later work, after he had turned away from this very achieved idiom, where there is, in the irregularity of the edges around, you know, the large fields, he had, that's where, you know, as I hope I was able to show in the talk, where the most evident movement complexity had migrated. And, you know, what happens with the change that you see in the name of the photograph is that that edge now becomes just set. And it's a simple division, you know, almost as if you would tape it off. And therefore, he's denied himself his greatest resource in terms of a painter, dramatist. And that was one of the earlier points you made, was the reactivity of both Shapiro and Rothko to changing circumstances around abstract art through the 50s into the 60s and so on. And I think that in Rothko's case, there was definitely a reaction to what was going on around him, even though he always attempted to keep it at bay or pretend as if it had no effect on him. And his desire to make the canvases, you know, your whole environment, so there was nothing else to look at, and put them right down to the floor and have them crowd together as long as they were his own canvases. What he hated was anyone else's art being seen in the vicinity of his, so that you would, you know, so they were on the scale of public monumental art, to use the Silos analogy, on the scale of the cloister reliefs, but they had the intimacy and the closeness to a single observer that the reader of a manuscript would have, that you don't read with someone else. It's, you read it as a single reader. Its scale is such that it would really only support the contemplation of one person. So he wanted to do that on a scale which in other hands would be seen as monumental or public or architectural. And he was always trying to hold those two seemingly opposed values or meanings in his art together. But I think as abstraction over the course of the 1950s becomes a norm, not something that you had to, in every painting, and somehow argue for or justify. The painting had to be an argument for its right to be non-objective. Once abstraction is accepted, of course, then it becomes, you have to argue for figuration, and Rothko had no intention of returning to that. So what he had to struggle to achieve was a given. So the struggle kind of lost its raison d'être, lost its underlying tension or dynamism. So he makes paintings which are, from the beginning, abstract, which are, from the beginning, exercises in design, a certain composition which he has already conceived. It's not discovered in the making of it, but set down to begin with, measured out, and then executed. Now, of the artists of his generation who benefited from this new attitude toward abstraction as a given, you know, the attitude that was producing younger competitors like Frank Stella, the older artist who benefited the most from this was Ad Reinhardt, who had for a long time, of course, been setting his edges very closely, using very dark, closely valued divisions of the canvas that took you a long time to see into and for the imagery of the canvas to kind of come to your awareness, you know, that didn't announce themselves instantly. And I think awareness of Ad Reinhardt's so-called black paintings as they became, you know, very much celebrated by the early 1960s certainly put Rothko on his mettle, and he was going to do something then which would, you know, go beyond what I think he believed to be Reinhardt's still rather mechanical approach. And what you're seeing here was the result of that movement on his part. And just thinking of, you know, the complexity of Shapiro's politics and by implication Rothko's politics, though he was never, you know, overtly partisan in his affiliations. I hadn't intended to read this out, and I'll have to put on my glasses even to see it, but I have a passage from a letter he wrote to his wife in the late 1920s from Silos. And let's see, where did I have the beginning of it? Yeah, August 1927, he writes, "What 4 days? I have not been so happy this whole voyage. The life is so good, I can well join my homely, upright friends and remain forever in this cloister. It is surely healthful and sane. It is also beautiful. And beside the world around, it is free from superstition, religion, strife, stupidity, wastefulness, disease, and bad manners. The religion is a reverent habit which gives a great dignity to everything done. There is no excess, no sermonizing, inquisitiveness, or self-torture. I have not eaten better in Spain. The food is grown within the monastery. There is beautiful fruit, delicious honey and wine, and Benedictine liqueur beyond words. One is rich here. The library is very rich, too, and the cloister sculptures of the 11th century are the finest works in the Spanish Romanesque, without any parallel and strangely isolated in history. Noble monks, generous life, fine talk and companionship, and apparently the perfection of freedoms." So Shapiro was somebody who knew how to occupy a state of contradiction, because, you know, this affirmation of the monastic life as something free of religion and opening on to freedom would have been hard to express once he got, you know, back to New York and back into his left-wing and popular front kind of, cohorts.
Except that you would find the same, I mean, the same kind of speech about the medieval period as the idea of a perfect communist time in many writings from artists in France at the same time. I think, I mean, if you look at the writings of Gleize or people like that in the 1920s and 30s, or even Delaunay or Léger, they say basically the same thing. I mean, taking the cathedral as a popular work of art where the whole society is working and where, aside from the darkness of religion, there's also a lighter possibility. And there's, in the French Popular Front manifestations, you can see these ideas coming back, even under in the writings of Jean Zay or people who were strongly anti-religious. So there's maybe, I don't know, I've always thought that Shapiro in this way was pretty much of his time also. And I don't know how it was in the U.S. about that. I don't think I've seen these parallels being made, as in France.
You know, his milieu is largely Jewish for one thing, and you wouldn't have had that upbringing that would have instilled some sense of a Catholic inheritance that might be in some way transmuted toward a communal, you know, or avant-garde kind of valence. So he largely kept these things to himself, as far as I know. And you spoke about the rather extraordinary speeches and articles he wrote on abstraction and the avant-garde in the late 1930s, where he was obviously still torn and still not quite sure what he thought. In 1936, he writes the first version, which you mentioned, The Social Bases of Art, and he's very hostile to abstraction. He sees it as a kind of narcissist bourgeois indulgence that rejects the communal, rejects, you know, plain and straightforward communication. But then 1 year later, he rewrites it at greater length and really anticipates the whole social history of 19th century art, modern life painting in Paris, as a qualified exploration of freedom in the realm of leisure time on the part of an emancipated bourgeoisie, and he's much more sympathetic. And within the space of 1 year, you have those two positions. And I think it was hard for all of them to kind of keep straight exactly what they thought. Times themselves were so immensely complex and rapidly changing, and the war approaching, and depression, rise of fascism. They were and trying to think of how what sense did that all make in when I walk into the studio or when Shapiro sits down to his typewriter. So it was very good that you drew that attention to that moment, intellectual moment.
There's one other thing I wanted to mention, or rather to question. It's this question of the presence of violence and all that in Rothko's work. I think we have a tendency to respect his words, but maybe too much. I don't think I've ever read an essay which argued very clearly about the actual presence of this violent content and of this rather dark, not visually, but spiritually, vision of the world in his works. And I've always thought that maybe Rothko's popularity is not a misreading of his work. Maybe what people see in it, like the serenity and even the dreamlike effect, is actually there, at least in the works up till the... there are some exceptions, and we can think about exceptions, and you showed some exceptions, maybe. But at the same time, there's always a window-like structure. There's always a kind of this layering of color makes for a very dreamlike space and not surface. Maybe in the work after 1957, 1958, where you have what you describe, that is these very simple planar arrangements where you have two planes, one color solid on another plane, and it's very clear cut, and there's no more any, I mean, it's coming forward instead of receding. But I've always had the feeling that, I mean, not always, but I've lately had the feeling that maybe there's always this problem for art historians to pay too much attention to the artist's sayings. And maybe with these plays on Rothko and the way he's seen by a lot of people, I've become conscious of this I don't know, contradiction or this fact that in fact he can be very popular because, well, first there's the tragic ending to the life, so that's one thing that's very, very important from James Dean to Kurt Cobain. It's essential to establishing a great artist figure. But apart from that, there's also the fact that it's very pleasing in some ways. And at the same time, you have all the writings which say, oh, okay, it's pleasing, but in fact, it's very violent, it's very sad, it's very dramatic. And you're feeling fine looking at the works, but in fact, you're being very profound by being entertained by this kind of work. I'm phrasing it very brutally. I know it might seem very prejudiced against Rothko, but and maybe it is. But I've always have. I mean, I've had trouble lately with this what I see as a contradiction between the works themselves and the writings of Rothko, especially since there's that much that has been published in the past 10 years or so, maybe a little bit less than 10 years, but I don't remember exactly. And maybe one turning point was actually an essay by Sarah Risch for the conference that you edited at the Getty, where she speaks about the relationship between the format of the paintings and some publicity images for businessmen, and which made it maybe clear that there was a contradiction that was normally not addressed in there. I don't know what your feeling is. Maybe I'm too brutal for. And please forgive me. I've been installing punk objects for the past week, so I'm.
Yeah, well, I think when I read the drafts for the Nietzsche essay, which were never published in his lifetime, or not at all known, for a long time thereafter, they kind of came out in an indirect way as photocopies made by his biographer James Breslin, and in his papers, they surfaced, and. The vehemence with which he expresses this, I hadn't encountered even in a lot of his intemperate recorded remarks of the kinds that turn up in the play. That this was at a deeper level, and one that carried a strong sense of conviction. So I set about trying to figure out what it was that might justify Rothko's own view of his work. And that's what really took me to the apocalyptic significance of the Mozarabic manuscripts, which I think Rothko may have seized upon and taken almost more seriously than Shapiro did himself, because Shapiro's own attraction was to the humanist Romanesque sculpture more than the archaic style of the manuscripts. And in fact, he spends most of his time talking about just one page in particular, which is quite anomalous, which is the hell page, which is a kind of a quatrefoil with no sort of fixed orientation, and with demons, violating the borders and so on, which is fascinating. And it's an exemplary artistic discussion. But the more common pages, the normative style, the banded style with the actors in front, all acting out, the plagues and the demons and the four horsemen and the beast and everything that's going on in the Book of Revelation, that went with the notion of violence being trapped in the paintings. And what it led me to see then, or believe I was seeing, was at the inception he was trying to build that in. And then the question would be, as he moved toward a mode of painting that answered other requirements, that is, it would be as large, as imposing, as saturated with color, and so on, as his compatriots were doing, as a Newman was doing or a Pollock was doing, and still have all that in there. My effort was to try to find a way to see the paintings as he would have seen them.
Yeah.
And whether that entirely carries over to the viewer is another question. The fact that he was so anxious about the conditions under which his paintings were being viewed, with all these requirements about subdued light and lowered position and no other works by any other artists in the vicinity, you know, bespeak this anxiety to preserve something that he still felt was there but was endlessly afraid that no one else would be able to perceive, much as you've just been describing. Yes. And, you know, that they hover there. You know, it might be a good qualification for me to say that they are suspended, really, between two conditions. Yeah.